if these mammals who are bitten because so many rodents have died in an epizootic, if these mammals are indeed humans, if they're of the human variety, the effects of such a bite are swift and often lethal, because humans are particularly vulnerable to this bacillus. Within 3 to 6 days of being bitten by a flea and having the bacillus injected into them by the flea bite, generalized symptoms like raised temperature, splitting headache, inflamed eyes, and giddiness begin to appear. And soon they are followed by those telltale signs of bubonic plague. The appearance of buboes, or inflammatory swellings, either, as in this case, under the armpit or in the groin. These buboes give to plague an additional label, because this is the most common but not the only form of plague. This is bubonic plague, taken from this word buboes to indicate these inflammatory swellings. On average, 60% of those infected in this way die within a week of the emergence of these buboes. If it is the movement of rodents which is so critical to the spread of bubonic plague, it is in one particular case not the movement of rodents but of humans which is critical. If bubonic plague becomes so pervasive that the bacillus infects the patient's lungs, then it can be spread from person to person, no longer needing the flea, by coughing particularly. And then it takes on an even direr form known as pneumonic plague, because it is spread person to person from the infected lungs of an individual. Pneumonic plague is even more dreadful and even swifter in its effect on human beings. It kills at a higher rate, and it spreads much more rapidly indeed, even before buboes can appear. So under this general label plague, you should recognize there are at least two, in fact there are three, but I will talk only about bubonic and pneumonic plague. Bubonic plague being the most common, spread by fleas, but also in particular circumstances, so infecting an individual's lungs that that individual's coughing can actually infect another person with very, very dreadful consequences. In the case of pneumonic plague, the case mortality rate, that's the number of people who contract it, who die, is up at 70 to 90%. So in the case of bubonic plague, perhaps about 60%. In the case of pneumonic plague, 70 to 90%. It seems likely that twice before the 19th century, the die-offs of rodents in the cycle reached epizootic proportions that the fleas turned to humans, producing the two great pandemics of bubonic plague that many people are aware of. The plague of Justinian in the 6th century AD, that's the first plague pandemic, and then the one which probably most people have heard of, the grim Black Death of the 14th century, which is really the second bubonic plague. The Black Death of the 14th century, which devastated Europe, North Africa, Asia, probably along with one of its later derivatives, the Great Plague of London of 1664-1665, caused such mortality that these two outbreaks were indelibly fixed in the minds and culture and folklore of generation after generation of Europeans, North Africans, and Asians. So much so that the two became almost synonymous, especially in Europe. Plague meant epidemic, and epidemic meant plague. But for our purposes, it's important to recognize that plague is just one of several epidemics. And bubonic plague, the best known of them, is the one which is most commonly referred to as plague. But it's an indication of how common plague was that it became the word, more or less, a synonym for epidemic in Europe in medieval and early modern times. There's no evidence that southern Africa was touched by either of these first two pandemics, the plague of Justinian or the Black Death. And that probably relates to what I was saying right at the beginning of yesterday. Southern Africa was isolated from the epicenters of these pandemics in Asia, in Middle East, in North Africa, and in Europe. However, by the end of the 19th century, that isolation by distance, by jungle, by sea, by desert, that isolation was no longer the case, thanks to the spread of global trade, the expansion of shipping maritime empires during the intervening centuries, which effectively breached that protection. And so when a third pandemic of bubonic plague began to appear in China and in India in 1894, 1895, 1896, the previous protection, the previous barriers which had prevented the Black Death and the plague of Justinian before it penetrating to southern Africa, those barriers were no longer in place. And the third plague pandemic, starting in the 1890s in China and in India, began to spread very swiftly around the world aboard steamships carrying grain, which was a natural environment for rats. And as this plague began to spread, so alarm bells began ringing in southern Africa at the possible approach of this third plague pandemic. And that there would no longer be an isolating barrier which would prevent its arrival. Alerted by horrifying reports of thousands of plague deaths in Asia, anticipating that it would be only a matter of time before what was labeled, and labeling is another key theme which we'll pick up all through this, labeling a disease as other, coming from somewhere else. It was labeled the Oriental Plague, because it came from there, from the Orient. Alerted by reports of what was happening in Asia, anticipating the arrival of this Oriental Plague, governments in southern Africa in the 1890s anxiously readied themselves against the arrival of what one doctor called the dreaded disorder, because it contained with it all of these dimensions from popular culture of Black Death, Plague of Justinian, Great Plague of London. Plague had a almost uniquely gruesome, terrifying effect because of its history, because of its place in folk culture. And so in Kruger's Transvaal in the 1890s, the Kruger government imposed restrictions on the movement of Indians because they assumed that Indians were automatically associated with the plague. There's again that othering, that pointing at others. In the Cape and in Natal, the governments sought to tighten port health controls. Initially, these preventive attempts seemed to have been successful. No further cases were reported in 1899, when the alarm bells had begun to ring very loudly, and early in 1900, as an indication of the efficacy of this series of tightening up maritime control, a ship which arrived in Cape Town in 1900 with a dead captain and sick crewmen was promptly quarantined by a very vigilant port health officer, and the ship was sent to Saldanha Bay to be put into quarantine. Its entire cargo of grain was unloaded and burnt. And so these restrictions, these attempts to keep plague at bay, seemed initially in 1899 and 1900 to have been successful. But when these precautions failed, it seems to have been primarily because they were overridden by Britain's military needs. So I need just to back off from this for the moment to explain to you what were Britain's military needs. Well, for some of you immediately, those years 1899 to 1902 will trigger. These are the years of the South African War. In October 1899, Southern Africa was plunged into that three-year war between Britain and the Boer republics of the Transvaal and the Orange Free State. And it's very clear, to be sure, the involvement of Southern Africa in the South African War swelled the number of human beings on the move. Vastly expanded imperial armies traversed the whole of Southern Africa. Large numbers of refugees fled from the Witwatersrand to Cape Town, to Port Elizabeth, to Durban, to East London. Lots of movement of individuals. But as I indicated right at the beginning, that's not the key to understanding the movement of bubonic plague. Far more important through the lens that we're looking at of plague was the fodder needs of the British Army, the need to provide grain for the horses of the British Army. To feed the horses of the army required the importation of vast, vast quantities of grain. This, the British Army sourced from all over the globe. Shiploads came in from east, from west, but most conveniently, large quantities of fodder were available from Argentina. Argentina, where in September 1899, cases of plague had begun to appear. Though it took some time, several months, before the Argentinian authorities would actually publicly declare that plague had broken out, but if we track back into Argentinian newspapers and reports in the second half of 1899, it's clear that plague cases were already appearing, particularly in Rosario, which was one of the big grain exporting ports in Argentina. And from Argentina to Cape Town, it's really not terribly difficult to reconstruct the path, a hay-strewn path, a path whereby the fodder was brought from Rosario to Cape Town, and from this to identify the pathway by which bubonic plague reached Southern Africa in 1900. Cape Town was the first significant port of entry, and again, in retrospect, what we're able to discover is that already in 1900, under the cloak of military control and military control of information, there's evidence that there was a large die-off of rats taking place in the sections of Cape Town Harbour restricted to military activity only. In September 1900, we discover a report, a secret military report, written about the situation in the military area of the Cape Town docks, which was closed to the general public. The stench was unendurable, and they had to have the floors up to remove the dead rats. The ordnance officer who wrote this report said he himself had seen numbers of sick rats coming out to the open in daylight in a dazed state so that you could catch them with your hand. All the markers of rats having contracted bubonic plague, having contracted plague. But news of this was kept very quiet and suppressed in the interests of the military needs of the British Army. The news of this was not even given to the Medical Officer of Health in Cape Town by the local military command. It wasn't until February 1901, that's 4 months later after this report from the ordnance officer, indeed 5 months, that two civilians who worked in the military section of the harbour fell ill with a disease and it was diagnosed, because they were not under military control, they went to their house doctors, it was diagnosed as bubonic plague. And at that point, the city's medical officer of health learned that, in his words, the dreaded bubonic plague, the scourge of India, has at length made its appearance in our midst. By the middle of March 1901, over 130 cases of plague had occurred in the peninsula, 56 of them fatal. If we then try and track the spread of bubonic plague from Cape Town Harbour, it's probable that it was transmitted to Port Elizabeth in the cargo of a ship which left from Cape Town. But what is quite striking is that bubonic plague, by and large, with one, two very significant exceptions, seems to have been restricted to the port cities, Port Elizabeth, Durban, East London. This may have something to do with the fact that the onset occurred at the beginning of winter, March, April, when temperatures in interior were falling, and rat fleas don't like cold temperatures. They tend to be less and less active. So this is a hypothesis. It's very striking that large numbers of troops are moving around, fodder is moving around, yet to a large extent the interior seems to have been relatively lightly touched by bubonic plague. So this is offered as a suggestion as to why that may have been the case. If Cape Town was the first significant port of entry for bubonic plague into southern Africa, then Durban was probably the second significant port of entry, infected from abroad, unlike Port Elizabeth, which was probably infected from Cape Town. In November 1902, the harbour in Port Elizabeth was infected by rats in a shipload of lucerne imported also from Argentina. And then, spreading from Durban, the district surgeon of East London claimed that East London was infected from Durban, probably by sea early in 1903, again a cargo of rat-infested grain. From East London, it seems to have penetrated a little into the hinterland, particularly along the railway line, and one can track it along the railway line in the border region, particularly to Queenstown and King Williamstown. The one really notable appearance of plague deep in the interior occurred in Johannesburg, and it's quite difficult to reconstruct how it reached there. But putting together the fragments of information, it rather seems that it was from East London that this deep penetration of the interior by the bacillus happened early in 1904, when a young Indian labourer who'd arrived in East London, already then in the throes of developing pneumonic plague, i.e. the plague spread person to person, not by fleas, this young Indian labourer seems contracted, we don't know where, plague, it turned into pneumonic plague. He travelled to Johannesburg from the coast and proceeded to infect his family and their neighbours in an area in what is today central Johannesburg, but then was labelled, in those racial terms of the time, Coolie location, an area which had been demarcated in the 1890s by the Kruger government where Indians should live in Johannesburg. And by then, there were a significant number of Africans living there as well, but it still retained the name Coolie location. And so in 1904, pneumonic plague appeared dramatically and unexpectedly in Johannesburg, particularly in Coolie location. That's the one really notable appearance of either bubonic or pneumonic deep in the interior, and that probably is the pathway by which it was reached, though, as I say, some of it is conjecture, one reconstructs from the situation at the time. As elsewhere in the world, however, and as I mentioned a moment ago, the most serious points of infection where it raged most deeply were at the ports, right at the heart of those seaports. Generally, the pattern of bubonic plague was that it was intense, it raged intensively, sudden and rapid increase in the number of cases, large number of deaths, but never comprehensively. It never really became a comprehensive epidemic affecting the whole of the population. For instance, in Cape Town, which was the worst hit port in South Africa, its actual incidence in the total population was less than 0.5%. Less than 0.5% of the total population actually contracted bubonic plague. But that, as I've already suggested to you, is not anything like an indication of the alarm which the appearance of plague triggered in any society, particularly in any society where stories of the Black Death, stories of the Great Plague of London were pervasive. That dreaded disorder that the doctor had talked about had a power to terrify well beyond the actual figures. 0.5% of the total population is not a runaway epidemic which threatens every individual. But the fact that it was plague really caused tremors of fear. You can see that depicted in this contemporary cartoon. All those evocations of horror conjured up by this cartoonist. Apart from the tales of the Black Death and the Great Plague of London, what particularly drove the fear was that once it was contracted, as I indicated, then there was a very high risk of people actually dying of the disease. If we look at the case mortality rate, i.e. the number of people who contracted it, who died, then we're up into terrifying regions. In the case of Cape Town, 48% of people who contracted it died. In the case of Johannesburg, where it was pneumonic plague, 73% of people who contracted it died. And in the case of Durban, where it was probably a combination of bubonic and pneumonic, 72%. So here's another source of terror. All the tales, all the cultural heritage of Black Death, Great Plague of London, but also evidence, if you contract it, there's a very strong chance that in fact you will die of it. This trajectory of plague outbreaks was usually then a sudden, sharp onset, generating a great deal of trepidation and panic as deaths rapidly mounted, but then generally a levelling off of cases and a steady abatement of the disease, with perhaps occasional, punctuated by occasional flare-ups. So sudden, sharp panic stations all round, and then levelling off, and then a slow decline, occasionally a sporadic flare-up. By the end of 1907, even the occasional flare-ups amongst humans had ceased, and the plague bacillus in southern Africa after 1907 was largely confined to rodents, amongst whom, I'm not sure whom is the right word and pronoun, amongst which plague then became endemic for the first time and has remained endemic amongst rodents in South Africa ever since. Medical authorities, we need now to get some idea of what was understood at the time by medical authorities if we understand the way in which people reacted. Medical authorities believed that whatever measures they took, they were the source of success in curbing the plague. They believed that whatever they did, however varied, that must have been the answer. Of course, they have a vested interest in demonstrating that their measures were the right ones. It's likely that perhaps in part they were correct, but this is probably not because they understood exactly the nature of the disease or how it was transmitted. It was not based on a complete understanding of the disease. At the time, in 1900, medicine, biomedicine's knowledge of plague, as indeed of all infectious and contagious diseases, was in the throes of a watershed transition as a result of the emergence of germ theory. So all ideas about all infectious diseases were very much in transition at that point because of the dramatic and tremendous discoveries by Pasteur and Koch in particular. And so plague in 1900 was understood by a combination of some of the pre-germ theory ideas and current emerging state-of-the-art ideas on infectious diseases. So generally the medical profession understood that plague was caused by a specific bacillus, but exactly how that bacillus was transmitted was not clear. For the medical profession, the belief was that somehow other rats were involved, and that fitted in particularly with pre-germ theory ideas because rats were so closely associated with filth, with insanitary conditions. And for many of them, filth, insanitary conditions were the obvious recipe for an epidemic. But where this bacillus came from, did it come from, as some said, it comes from the filth-saturated soil. That's a contemporary quote. Somehow that the ground had been so pervaded by the bacillus that just a shower of rain would produce this and it would suddenly begin to emerge into the air. That's what some of the doctors said. Others associated with overcrowding, with insanitary dwellings, some associated with the rat itself. So not very great certainty about where the bacillus came from, how it emerged, and certainly much greater uncertainty about how it was transmitted. Did it come directly from the rat? Did it come from one person to another? Even as one bacteriologist, expert at the time said, maybe it comes from the rat via its fleas, to which many of his contacts said, no, how can that possibly be? How can that possibly be? Well, it's very much a time in flux, and so no well-established single explanation. And that we need to understand if we are to interrogate and have a look at the responses and the countermeasures. If the idea was that the disease could spread from person to person, most doctors believed that as a result of that, isolation, quarantine of cases or of anyone who had been in contact with those cases was a prerequisite. So one of the very first responses was quarantine. Quarantine of individuals who had the disease, or anyone who was in contact with them. Here's some illustrations of this at work in Cape Town at the time. Here's a house in Bree Street. Whoops, there was a house in Bree Street. Here's a house in Bree Street, and you can see that these people, a case has occurred there. There's the ambulance to take away the case, and the rest of the contacts, the rest of the residents in the house have been put out onto the balcony. And here we can see a close-up of these men kept under confinement on the balcony to make sure that they remain there. There's a policeman. So here's a case of contacts being quarantined in the house where the case had occurred. Often what happened, I don't know what street this was in Cape Town, is that when the case occurred, a dark yellow flag was placed outside the house and the date when the case had been found placed on the wall, 23rd March. And once again, you can see here's a policeman just holding his truncheon to make sure that the contacts in the house do not move from there. So here you can see almost inevitably, one of the first responses recommended by medical opinion, quarantine. Quarantine, K cases, take them away, put them into a special plague hospital, and those contacts should be quarantined either where in the house where the case had occurred or somewhere else. This diversity of medical opinion, should we do this, should we do that, really is apparent right through South Africa, not just in Cape Town. Generally, it looks to me that most doctors tried an overarching composite approach, what you might call a blunderbuss approach. Try almost everything because at least one of them is likely to have some effect. Though particular doctors put special emphasis on one or other particular measure which they believe really would be at the crux of preventing the disease spreading. All of them took sanitary measures, all of them still very much imbued with this idea that dirt equals disease, that insanitary conditions breed every disease possible, including a plague. And this particularly they associated with them, with others. Doctors, all white, indeed, other than one, all white males, and particularly fingers were pointed at areas where black South Africans live and associated those with dirt, insanitary conditions. Then, as now, as I indicated yesterday, the acute threat posed by an epidemic called forth existing social prejudices to find a scapegoat, someone to point the finger at and say, you're to blame, not us. Given the increasingly racialized nature of South African society at the beginning of the 20th century, particularly the others at whom whites pointed their fingers were Africans and Indians, outsiders, not part of us, part of them. Africans and Indians especially living in our white towns. You can see this very clearly illustrated in the caption to this one. Taken in Cape Town, a suspicious case. A policeman guarding a Kaffir woman supposed to be suffering from plague. Meantime, the plague ambulance is sent for. So here's someone who's showing some symptoms, or apparently some symptoms. She's hauled out of the house. Policeman is sent to guard her until she can be removed in the plague ambulance to a special plague hospital. In Cape Town, the city's medical officer of health, Dr. Barnard Fuller, believed that, quote, uncontrolled Kaffir hordes were at the root of the aggregation of Cape Town's slumdom brought to light when the plague broke out. Because of them, it is absolutely impossible to keep the slums of the city in a satisfactory condition. And we find similar expressions of social prejudice, of racial prejudice, amongst almost all of the doctors in South Africa at the time. In King Williamstown, one spoke of Africans who, with their filthy habits, they've brought the disease into the town, even though we know, in fact, that the disease was brought to King Williamstown aboard cargo of fodder from East London. In Durban, again, a similar racialized tunnel vision saw whites alarmed that the public health menace posed by the city's Africans stemmed from them. Again, even though we know that it was infected, it was rats aboard Lucerne, cargoes of Lucerne imported from Argentina who were responsible. In Port Elizabeth, the district surgeon's prejudices were indeed without any restraint at all. I mean, this is the blunderbuss approach to everyone who's other. The plague outbreak is the result of the mixed population in Port Elizabeth. Hottentots, Kaffirs, Chinese, Indians, who specially predisposed to overcrowding in insanitary dwellings. In the case of Johannesburg, it was particularly Indians, again, another minority, another out-group, another group without political voice, in that coolie location where the center, where the outbreak occurred, who attracted whites' sharpest condemnation. In the words of the Rand Daily Mail, Indians were perceived to have filthy habits and gross perversion of the most elementary sanitary rules. Under any circumstances, the Indian makes filth and surrounds his habitation with the germs of every disease under the sun. Keep those coolies as far away as possible from the centers of white population. And it had similar sentiments to express about Africans living in coolie locations. Epidemics and the fear, the threat to life which they pose, strip away all kinds of veneer and produce these very crude ideas about the other who are threatening our life. Given the extent and depth of the fear let loose by plague, it's not really very surprising that this kind of crude racial pathologizing informed almost every official measure taken against the plague at the behest of special plague committees or boards which were set up. It really provided these boards, these emergency plague boards or plague committees, with a compelling, overarching, overwhelming justification to tackle the epidemic as it stood, the immediate epidemic, but also a host of other perceived racialized social ills. In many ways, for me, it's possible to link two words to this kind of response: epidemic expediency. Epidemics used to produce a whole series of measures going well beyond just dealing with the epidemic, but addressing concerns which perhaps have been long simmering in a society. Epidemic expediency. In Cape Town, in Port Elizabeth, in Durban, in King Williamstown, in Johannesburg, epidemics therefore triggered house-to-house searches for new cases, for these contacts, and particularly concentrated and focused on areas inhabited by Africans and by Indians. Many of them were accused of deliberately hiding and concealing cases to prevent the houses being identified as the source of an epidemic. In Johannesburg, and it's important to remember that by 1904, Johannesburg was newly under British control, recently British military control, but in 1904, British municipal control. In Johannesburg, this new British-dominated municipality was very determined to show that it had state-of-the-art responses to a threat of plague. Quite unlike the old Boer-controlled Johannesburg, the new British-controlled Johannesburg really was almost going to use this as a way of demonstrating its efficiency in dealing with this age-old plague. Within hours of the disease, which was rampant in Coolie location in March 1904, being officially diagnosed as pneumonic plague, the entire Coolie location was cordoned off by police. Here you can see policemen, I'm not sure who that is, part of a long cordon around the whole of Coolie location. Within hours, the whole of Coolie location was cordoned off with police. No one was allowed to leave it. In the words of the Rand Plague Committee's medical officer, in view of the possibly widespread infection, it was deemed wiser to treat all the inhabitants, for the time at least, as suspects and not as mere contacts. It would have been impossible to have inspected them daily had the cordon been broken and the inhabitants allowed to go where they pleased. So a comprehensive quarantine on the whole of Coolie location, 3,000 people, because the first cases had occurred there. Tightly enforced, no one allowed out, and only selected people allowed in to provide food and medication. Dwellings in which cases were discovered were also dealt with, in most cases, in a racially selective way, stemming from those existing underlying prejudices linking race to insanitary living conditions. In Port Elizabeth, in Durban, and in King Williamstown, buildings where cases were identified to have occurred, which were occupied by Africans or Indians, were commonly demolished or burnt, the inhabitants sent to an emergency tent camp. Very different treatment of white or coloureds were living in a house where cases were identified. The building was fumigated, disinfected, and erstwhile residents allowed to return after the epidemic. Cape Town, however, scapegoated Africans in particular. Here's one of these fumigation teams in Kieron Street in Cape Town. Case had occurred there. They've gone in with poison gas, with spades, with brooms, and they've fumigated. This was a restaurant in Kieron Street. But particularly, as I indicated, Africans in Cape Town, a relatively small minority living in Cape Town, identifiable, they were the special target for anti-plague measures in the city. The link was that many of the earliest cases had occurred amongst African stevedores working at the docks. Many of them lived in District 6, and the crude link was made. African, highly likely, therefore, to be a plague contact. And consequently, the entire African community of Cape Town were marched out of District 6 and removed in terms of the city's public health, of the colony's public health act. 6,000 of the city's Africans were forced to leave their homes, escorted by soldiers, as you can see here, through the streets of Cape Town to a special tent camp at Uitvlucht Forest Station on the Cape Flats, 5 miles away from the city centre. There's a photograph of the Uitvlucht, a special plague camp at Uitvlucht. 6,000 Africans were all medically examined. They were vaccinated with a crude vaccine which had been developed, and they were accommodated in supposedly more sanitary accommodation.
So where's this age?
Dabeni. Coloured and white Cape Townians, however, if they were living in a house where there would be, where there'd been contacts, were removed to a different emergency camp. They're Africans at the plague camp at Uitvlucht. Coloured and white contacts were removed to a separate tent camp just about where the Cape Town Stadium is today, if you get your bearings. And as I indicated, once their homes had been fumigated and cleaned, they were allowed to return to those homes. Certainly not the case for Africans. Johannesburg, once again, under this efficient, hyperactive new municipality, British-dominated municipality, outstripped the other cities in its sanitary zeal. The Rand Plague Committee had all of those 3,000 people whom it had cordoned off, Indians, Africans, and a few coloureds, had them thereafter removed under armed guard and sent to a municipal farm at Klipspruit, 12 miles west of Johannesburg. There they were put into tents and to huts, into two distinctive, racially separate camps, a mile apart, one camp for Africans, one camp for Indians, both surrounded by a contingent of troops to make sure that no one would leave those camps. Only their clothing, their bedding, and their utensils, which had been disinfected, were allowed into these camps. All other possessions which they held had to be left behind for fumigation or for burning, except in the case of laundrymen who did laundry for white Johannesburg citizens. Their laundry, the laundry of whites, was fumigated and returned to their owners. Back in Johannesburg, the now empty Coolie location was burnt to the ground. In a moment I'll tell you. Burnt to the ground by, paradox of paradoxes, the Johannesburg Fire Brigade, which produced lots and lots of petrol, oil, and spread it around and set the coulee location ablaze. Even more dramatic, sorry, I should just point out, you can still see a fence, a corrugated iron fence around coulee location, and then the whole of the location put to flame. Lots of interested spectators. And perhaps more dramatic, though not as clear, the coulee location going up in flames. Coulee location is where today Newtown is. The new Johannesburg Market was built on that site, together with other municipal buildings. Racially selective measures were in evidence too in the restrictions placed on travel by rail or by sea out of infected ports by Indians or Africans. It was required that any Indian or African travelling from Cape Town or Durban or any place where a plague had occurred had first to have a plague pass issued by a medical authority after that person had been medically examined and shown that they had no signs, no symptoms of the disease. In Port Elizabeth, the plague board's imperiousness went even further. It sought to compel local Africans to be vaccinated with this new experimental anti-plague vaccine across the board. Every African had to be vaccinated. To achieve this, it insisted that plague passes would be issued to Africans only if they'd been medically examined and vaccinated. Coming on top of a host of other discriminatory measures against Port Elizabeth Africans, this was the last straw for many of them, and it triggered, in the midst of the war, an unprecedented general strike by African workers in the city against this forced vaccination. Their withdrawal of their labour in the midst of the war, particularly the labour of stevedores, who were critical to the operation of Port Elizabeth's harbours, was enough to convince the board that it had overstepped the mark, and it relented on this. Elsewhere in southern Africa, local circumstances dictated the authorities' stance on vaccination. In Cape Town, the colonial medical officer had already decided that, except for those Africans who had been forced out to Uitvlucht, mass vaccination would not be pushed too strongly. It was made available to anyone who wanted it. It was not compulsory. Particularly because word began to get around that it had unpleasant side effects, and indeed rumours that perhaps some people who had been vaccinated with this experimental vaccine had actually died. And once again, that rumour, which we saw in the case of smallpox, that in fact this was not an anti-plague vaccine, but one which gave one plague. Again, indicating deep suspicion, circumspection, hostility, that the authorities were hostile to the population. Similar reasons in Durban and in Johannesburg prevented mass vaccination campaigns. Probably the only anti-plague measure on which all humans in Southern Africa agreed, and that's a rare achievement in South Africa then as now, the only area in which they agreed was the need to kill rats. In every town, even the merest hint of an outbreak persuaded local authorities to step up their standard rat-catching campaigns. But now, rats were that had been caught were given a bacteriological analysis for evidence of the bacillus. If an outbreak did subsequently occur, the campaign was accelerated, reaching almost frenetic levels, as you can see in this tongue-in-the-cheek cartoon. Extra teams of rat catchers were hired. The public were offered a bounty of threepence for every rat brought to a municipal depot. The sale of rat traps, rat poison, rat-proofing soared. Every plague report of the time breathes this anti-rat fervor. In all, and it's of course very difficult to know how accurate this is, which if I look at all the figures, because they're tabulated, how many rats have been killed in each one. In all, probably over 250,000 rats were killed during these years from 1901 to 1907 in southern Africa. Paradoxically, and of course this is with retrospect and with retrospect knowledge, paradoxically, epidemiologists nowadays tell us that in the midst of a plague epidemic, the killing of rats is actually not a good idea because it causes their infected fleas to desperately seek out other mammals on which to feed, and therefore spreading the epidemic even more widely. But that's knowledge after the event. But it's perhaps a perspective which we should bear in mind. Excuse me, I just need a glass of water. Compared to this 250,000 or more rats who were killed during the years 1901 to 1907 in southern Africa, the number of humans who died of plague, either bubonic or pneumonic plague, was relatively small. 958, really a very small number in terms of epidemics. And that really is almost minuscule compared to the very large numbers who died in Hong Kong or in India, where we're talking of tens of thousands of bubonic plague deaths. But the case mortality, that's the number of people who had contracted it, who died, that did remain high. If we look at across all the cities where it occurred, across the period from 1901 to 1907, 55.9% of people who contracted it died. And that's very much on par with the high figure elsewhere. But that small total number, 958 deaths across South Africa in those 6 years, does raise the question about the overall significance of plague in South Africa in these years. Certainly, one senior contemporary, Dr. Ernest Hill, who was the medical officer of health for the colony of Natal, he rated the plague epidemic as of relatively little importance. Here's what he says. I have studiously avoided the word epidemic as conferring too much importance on any outbreak which in 7 months attacked no more than about 3 1/3 per thousand of the entire population in Durban, being a far less prevalence than that of enteric fever or dysentery amongst the European portion. And I don't think in sheer demographic terms, Dr. Hill was wrong. But if one is to assess the significance of the plague epidemic in South Africa, you need to go beyond just numbers of people who died. One needs to also look, as I've been hinting through this lecture, at the social and political importance as well. In particular, its decisive role in shifting the residential segregation of Africans in towns and cities across South Africa onto a very different plane. One historian looking at this argues it was the merest step of logic to proceed from the isolation of plague victims to the creation of a permanent location for the black labouring class. With the plague emergency, the definitive step of quarantine and segregation was taken. And so if we look at some of the longer consequences of the plague epidemic in Southern Africa, they become quite prominent. That emergency camp at Uitvlug, to which the bulk of the city's African population had been dispatched during 1901, was turned into a permanent location called, as I indicated, Ndabeni, Cape Town's first African location, the predecessor to Langa. Quite simply, the plague provided an unchallengeable opportunity in the face of a terrifying threat to life for segregation lobbyists within the white establishment to push aside all previous opposition to the idea of racial segregation in their long-sought goal of effecting a mass removal of Africans to a single controllable location away from the city, on the outskirts of the city. Something which they had been trying to achieve already since the 1890s, but had been unable to overcome the obstacles, political, social, and economic, to that. In this regard, it's quite telling to pick up a comment by the Cape Argus at the time. Maybe, it said, the plague has been a blessing in disguise for Cape Town, with particular reference to the way in which it permitted Africans to be removed permanently. In Port Elizabeth, the plague epidemic performed a not dissimilar function, giving the white powers that be a powerful argument to attain, at least in part, a goal which they had been striving for since the mid-1890s, the closure of the four rather haphazardly run and haphazardly located African locations within the inner city of Port Elizabeth, and to transfer those Africans from these dotted around, rather ramshackle locations within central Port Elizabeth to a single, well-ordered, well-controlled location beyond Port Elizabeth, New Brighton. The opening of New Brighton as a custom-built location for Africans, 5 miles from central Port Elizabeth, was intended by the authorities to be the culmination of their plan for the mass removal of Africans. To this end, in 1903, they formally disestablished what was left of the four inner city locations, and here you can see what happened to Strangers' location, one of them. Again, it went up in flames, burnt to the ground. The inhabitants were removed, and the belief was that they would now stream in numbers to New Brighton, thereby creating a distinct, separate location, one place away from central Port Elizabeth. In fact, however, most Africans in Port Elizabeth initially chose not to go to New Brighton because the conditions there, they believed, would be rather onerous and oppressive in terms of their comings and goings. Many of them sought accommodation on the fringes of Port Elizabeth to avoid going to New Brighton. It had taken the just 4 years from the plague board's first steps in 1901 to accomplish what Port Elizabeth Town Council had been attempting to achieve for the past 40 years, to force many African residents in the inner locations out of the town. So again, under the cloud of, under the threat, under the fear of plague, the inner city locations were razed, removed, and no longer Africans lived in central areas of Port Elizabeth. In King William's Town, a similar pattern. The very mere possibility of a plague spreading there prompted the town council to create a brand new location to which Africans should be dispatched. Ginsburg location, also on the outskirts of the town. It was hoped that Ginsburg location would become a magnet for Africans, and it would then also be this distinct, single location where Africans live. In the wake of one of those flare-ups of plague in 1907, Africans were forcibly removed from anywhere else on the fringes of King William's Town and compelled to live in Ginsburg location. In the case of Johannesburg, I've already suggested to you a determination to act, and act forcefully and extensively. In the case of Johannesburg, it took advantage of the fact that Indians and Africans had been removed to this farm 12 miles west of Johannesburg, a municipally owned farm, to try and turn this into a permanent location. And in that way, redraw the city's racial geography permanently into a clearly segregated colonial city from which the old, loosely segregated city center locations had been removed, and in which racially mixed areas were a thing of the past. In the words of the Public Health Committee, the Johannesburg Public Health Committee, there should be, quote, a proper wholehearted treatment of this coloured question, which would unscramble the way in which the Malays, the Indians and the Kaffirs were jumbled all over the place under overcrowded and insanitary conditions. The wholesale removal of the natives from the town would place us in a better position to protect ourselves against the outbreaks of disease and would lessen their frequency and virulence. In pursuit of this vision of a modern, ordered, racially segregated city, a model British colonial town, the town council invoked a bylaw to compel all the city's Africans, not just those who'd been moved out to Cliffs Break, but all the city's Africans who didn't reside on their employer's premises to move to Cliffs Break by 1 April 1906 to join those Africans who'd already been forcibly removed there from Coolie location in 1904. The town council hoped also that the Indians who'd been removed to Cliffs Break, they would be able to force them to remain there, and there would be a separate Indian area created 1 mile away from the African camp. However, they were unable to achieve this because of a sensitivity that this might alienate the government of India and might produce a intervention from Westminster. And so Indians could not be forced to remain out there, and they began to drift back into Johannesburg already by the end of 1904. Really end this segregation of an Indian camp out of Cliffs Break. This ad hoc manner in which Cliffs Break became an African location, the location for Johannesburg, really belies its lasting historical significance. Despite its distance from central Johannesburg, 12 miles away, despite its proximity to sewage farms, despite its generally insalubrious living conditions, it became the prime focus of residence for Johannesburg's African population because it offered space to expand. In 1934, this African plague, or had been an African plague camp out at Cliffs Break, was renamed Pimville, and as such became the nucleus around which subsequent townships were constructed after World War II to accommodate the thousands of Africans flocking to the city of gold. In 1963, the now 26 townships west of Johannesburg centered on Pimville, which had been Cliffs Break, to which Africans had been removed forcibly in 1904, these 26 townships were renamed Soweto. So at the heart of Soweto lies the old Cliffs Break location dating back to the 1904 forced removal. From small germs, great townships grow. It's in this episode that the larger long-term impact of the plague bacillus on southern Africa is visible. Even before its constituent territories, those four colonies, were unified into a single state in 1910, it's clear that its policymakers were responding to the growing African, Indian presence in the towns and cities of the colonies in ways which were not dissimilar. We can bracket together Ndabeni, New Brighton, Ginsberg, Cliffs Break, all bearing testimony to this fact. Here you can see the epidemic expediency at work. The epidemic offered an opportunity, an unchallengeable opportunity, to implement ideas which had been floating around for some time already, but had been thwarted by vested interests, by opposition, by reluctance, by barriers. In the face of plague, none of those could be sustained. And every one of those owes its origin to the plague emergency. So one really needs to recognize that the bubonic plague had an impact out of all proportion to the number of lives it took. The many times magnified effect derived, as I've been arguing all through this lecture, from those frightening connotations that the word plague had for contemporaries steeped in Western culture and the greater authority attached to biomedical opinion at the time. Paradoxically, however, neither the frightening dimensions of the word plague nor the ideas and measures based on medical opinion at the time were actually well-based. As I've suggested, they actually really didn't have that amount of deadly effect, nor indeed were the medical measures actually built on a real clear understanding. Thank you very much.